today, partly sunny and very warm with a high of 83. Right now, humidity at 80%, 76 Kenosha, 75 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This past Thursday, I took some time to record a wide-ranging interview with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science, talking about various aspects of the current presidential campaign. As we recorded that interview to be aired today, we both kind of remarked to each other half-jokingly that we hoped nothing of terrible consequence would occur between Thursday and today. And of course, we were sadly, tragically wrong about that. We are all acquainted by now with the terrible events that unfolded at the Donald Trump campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, an assassination attempt which resulted in the death of at least one person present and other serious injuries. And so with all of that in mind, I appreciate Professor Mast being willing to join me over the telephone to recast some of the commentary that we covered in that interview on Thursday. And by the way, that interview as recorded on Thursday is still available if people are interested in seeking it out in the podcast version of the morning show. And but otherwise, today we need to be talking about this topic in a very different light. Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show and thank you for this second opportunity to be part of the morning show.
Well, you're welcome, Greg, and thanks again for the opportunity to try to make sense of this stuff.
Right. So where were you when you heard the news of this terrible incident of violence in Butler, Pennsylvania, and what were your initial reactions to it on a very just sort of personal, visceral level?
Well, I spent Saturday paying no attention to politics at all. I was visiting with relatives down in the Chicago area. A cousin of mine retired from my career as a school nurse. Her 60th birthday was there, and so it was a gathering of family, and it was really nice. It was a real kind of moment, a handful of hours away from politics. I learned of the event when I came home to Milwaukee and saw the news, and you know, it's shocking, not surprising, and we're in this kind of strange, you know, historical moment in which things can shock us but not surprise us. Yeah, so that's where I was, and that was my initial response.
Right. You have, I know, been following much of the commentary, much of what has been said by various political leaders and commentators, and of course President Biden himself. What do you make of general reaction to this incident in Butler, Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, a lot of it is disappointing, I guess. Some of it is encouraging. The thing that's the reaction, I guess, that stood had the most impact on me and it stayed with me is an essay of David French. David French is a conservative essayist for the New York Times, and he wrote today some reflections on it, and he was reflecting on it through a poem that I've been paying a lot of attention to the last few years, and that's William Butler Yeats' Second Coming, in which Yeats says, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy's loosed upon the world, and the blood-dimmed tide is loosed." Yeats is talking about 1919, the world in 1919, the end of World War One, and of course, in a historical moment that is still portentous and moving us towards World War Two, and David French is saying the center must hold, the center must hold, and this raises this question of what does Yates and French mean by the center? And they don't mean like political moderate, left, right, center. They mean the moral center of civilization, is how French puts it, and I completely agree with him. It is central in the sense that it is the core of our public life, and that has to be a collective belief in the morality of institutions and norms and rule of law. And in our civilization, the equal consideration of interests of all society members in respect for our fellow citizens in the civic arena. If that center can't hold, right, we risk anarchy. We risk this blood-dimmed tide. And there's all sorts of things that are caustic to this moral center of civilization: lies, conspiracy theories, intensely polarizing views about what our public interests are, partisan attacks and extreme rhetoric, and of course, violence. And Donald Trump was the victim of an unconscionable act of violence this weekend, abhorrent for the harm, right, that it does to Mr. Trump, but also to the gentleman who was killed, to the men who are now in critical condition. And as a society, we've got to condemn this in the strongest terms possible. So, I mean, I guess that's my initial reaction. That's the argument that sticks with me the most, that I found to be the most compelling. But, you know, there are other elements of reaction that are going on right now that are not as laudatory, I think. And so, I mean, the argument that this isn't who we are, or this is not part of American politics, it can't be part of America, that's papering over some real problems that we have. The last president, right, to be shot was Ronald Reagan in 1981. But every president since Reagan has been the target of assassination plots that have been foiled somewhere along the line before they could reach fruition. The number of death threats against members of Congress has spiked over the last 10 years. U.S. Representative Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, was shot in 2017. Thankfully, he survived his wounds. In 2022, a deranged man broke into the house of Nancy Pelosi looking for the Speaker of the House and ended up nearly beating her husband to death. We have the violent assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th in 2021. That wasn't just an attack on a building and the men and women who protect it, but an attack on the moral center of our republic's civilization. And I have to say, individuals who commit acts of political violence have to be accountable for their actions. We must blame the individuals who commit these acts of violence for their acts. But the character of the nation's politics affects the views and attitudes and the behavior of its citizens. There can't be any question about that. The question, for me anyway, Greg, in the wake of this terrible weekend, is how do we change our politics?
It's because, in a sense, when we say, this is not us, we are better than this, what you're basically saying is that's wrong. That's a lie of delusion that, in fact, right, this is all too clear a reflection of the current state of affairs in our nation, and we need to think about that fundamental issue in reaction to this.
That's right. These sorts of things are not representative of all Americans by any stretch of the imagination. Most Americans, I think, are decent people, decent, law-abiding, peaceful people. However, not all of them are, right? And there are many people in this country who are unhinged, whose politics are fairly delusional and misguided. And so whether or not they themselves are evil people or just people whose viewpoints have been warped by the larger political discourse, that's an important question, and we have to pay attention to the character of our politics that allows for the emergence of people who have very unhinged perspectives, because some of them are engaged in these terrible acts of violence.
Mm-hmm. I guess that melds nicely into the matter of the Republican National Convention, which, of course, is about to open in Milwaukee. In fact, it opens today as people are hearing this conversation that we are recording Sunday afternoon. So we already talked about the Republican convention, but that was on Thursday. In light of what occurred on Saturday in Butler, Pennsylvania, do we know very much about the way in which this convention will unfold and the ways in which it will be very directly and tangibly affected by that terrible incident?
Well, we don't know, right? But, you know, I think there's some reasonable expectations that we can have in terms of its impact. The Republican National Convention, right, is likely to be a kind of celebration of Mr. Trump, to coronate him as the nominee of the party. They're going to unveil narratives about why Mr. Trump is the best person to move the country forward. They'll unveil a narrative, right, about the Democrats and why they should be rejected by the electorate. And, you know, I think, you know, this event, this assassination attempt is likely to affect those narratives quite a bit. And you know, the Donald Trump has been the victim this weekend, but much of his rhetoric has been fairly overblown, right? His rhetoric has been fairly extreme, and he has some, you know, fingerprints on the degree to which there's fear and anger in significant amounts in the political culture. And so, you know, one of the things we need to be paying attention to, right, is will these conventions be crafting narratives that reflect this weekend's event in order to exploit it for partisan gain? And in the process, weakening the moral center of our civilization in the process, or will they try to repair that center, right? And you know, I'm not an optimist. I've paid a lot of attention to American politics in the last, you know, 8 years, and there are all sorts of incentives for the parties to cast each other in extremely negative light.
And it's likely that we may see then a continuation of that, or that's what you fear.
That's what I fear, and it's what I expect, actually. I mean, the Democratic Party holds its convention in Chicago in August, and it seems pretty clear that the Biden campaign had expected to base a campaign on the threats that it argues Donald Trump presents to the Republic, that he is a threat to democracy, that his actions on January 6th, 2021, and in the weeks prior to that, reflect a kind of hostility to democracy, a threat to democracy. And it's going to be harder, right, for them to push that narrative if, in fact, the attempt to attempted assassination makes Donald Trump into a much more sympathetic figure. Hmm.
One of the things that will occur, of course, at this Republican National Convention is the announcement of who will be his running mate as vice president. And there are several front runners. And I believe you are thinking that J.D. Vance is probably the front runner of the front runners. Do you have any reason to be shifting that opinion in the light of this weekend's events?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I haven't thought about it deeply, but Mr. Vance has spoken out and has been very, very critical of Democratic rhetoric. And to be clear, I find some of that rhetoric to be overblown, no doubt, on the part of the Democrats towards Mr. Trump. Exaggerated, yes. On the other hand, it seems that Mr. Vance's focus on the Democrats' rhetoric is missing the fact that we have two parties, and both of these parties have engaged in discourse that has led us to this kind of political cultural moment. I think that if Mr. Trump does indeed decide to go with Mr. Vance, this signals a kind of pugnacious or pugilistic approach to moving forward. I think that there's real kind of perils to society around that kind of politics.
Dr. Gerald Mast is professor of political science at Carthage College. We'll be hearing more from Professor Mast a little later in the program in some of what we recorded in our conversation on Thursday. But Professor Mast, I do appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday afternoon to offer a few more thoughts for today's morning show. I appreciate very much and look forward to further conversations with you in the coming weeks and months.
Thanks, Greg. That's very important issues that we all have to try to make sense of.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On Saturday, not long after the news broke of the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump, WGTD General Manager David Cole reached out to Kevin McDougall, who is sales manager for 5K Events. This is the organization that manages for the city of Racine both Memorial Hall and Festival Park. Festival Park was the venue for Donald Trump's appearance in Racine last month, an event not unlike the campaign event in Butler, Pennsylvania, which ended so tragically. Dave Cole thought it would be interesting to get kind of a behind-the-scenes look at least some of what goes into organizing an event of that magnitude, particularly when it comes to matters of security. Dave Cole began by asking Kevin McDougall at what point the organization 5K became aware of this impending visit from Donald Trump and his campaign.
They reached out. It was early June, and you know when they reach out, they're kind of coy about who they are. They reach out. They don't say who they are. They say we have an event we want to bring to your venue, looking at about 2,500 people. They give you the date, and you kind of have an idea of what it might be given the season. And the current climate and political season, you kind of have an idea. And we had kind of gone through a similar thing with the Biden visit to Sturtevant in May. So we kind of had our antenna up a little bit. But a few days after that, they did reply and say yes. It's us. It's the Trump team. And so we started some deeper conversations, and then ultimately it came to pass that they did want to come through the park and have an outdoor event, and it moved pretty quickly from there. The event was slated for the 18th, and the Trump advance team and the Secret Service were in town from June 13th forward. So they were pretty much in Racine and at Festival Park from June 13th right up until the date of the event. In looking at things that happened today, in Pennsylvania, they had a much larger footprint to secure than they have at than we had at Festival Park, obviously. But they looked at every vantage, elevated and otherwise. They met with the city engineers from Racine to look at all the sewer laterals coming into the park. So they really looked at every possible way that someone could get into the park, get a weapon into the park. Very, very thorough. So it was really kind of an interesting project to work on.
Now, as I recall, the stage basically was set on the eastern end of Festival Park, correct?
It was southeast. So
southeast.
It was kind of, yeah, it was facing the marina for the most part. They brought, and we have a fixed stage at the park, but that faces south toward the hall. And they kind of wanted a more picturesque background, and they wanted the bleachers behind him with a crowd behind him. So they brought, we worked with General Rental to rent a stage and bleachers and had those brought in. And then they put, the media deck out in the middle of the lawn, and then built a comms deck behind the bleachers. So, it was just kind of their vision. And it was very similar to what you've seen at other Trump rallies, very similar to the setup, they had in Pennsylvania today, where they had, his lectern kind of set up in the middle there. And then they had the runway, going off to the one side, very similar to what we had in Racine. And, kind of an interesting fact is that, kind of star-spangled, banner you see in front of the lectern there, that's actually armored, obviously for, good reason today. When he ducks down under it, it's made for shelter for just such an emergency. So, really, really kind of interesting how it all comes together.
So the podium was basically facing west, and there probably would be what, maybe a 2 football field lengths between the podium and, is it Lake, the first street immediately to the west of Festival Park?
Well, yeah, Lake Avenue would be to the west. It's probably about the length of a football field. Well,
okay.
The podium when he spoke in Racine was kind of facing northwest. So if you look toward like Lakeshore Towers, the condo complex, it was kind of facing directly at the condo complex. So, but kind of northwest was the lectern that he was speaking from was facing when he was in Racine.
So I guess what I'm getting at here is, was there any concern expressed, or did you have any concern about, some of the buildings across the street and a little further north, and was that of concern to the Secret Service?
They of course do look at all the, elevated vantages. Now, the one thing that was helpful with Festival Park is a lot of the area that he might have been exposed to is covered by, or is kind of obscured by, the colonnade at Festival Park. So, especially when it came to the apartment complexes on the west side of the park. So unless you're at the very top of, say, the arcade apartment buildings across the street, that would really be the only way to get, for lack of a better term, a good shot or a vantage. But even then, you're obscured by the colonnade and then Festival Hall itself. So really, if you were going to attempt something like that, it would have to come from the north, from Lakeshore Towers. And they were having conversations about talking to the management of Lakeshore Towers to, put Secret Service or Homeland Security personnel in empty condos that, weren't, owned or occupied on the balconies. I don't know if they ultimately did that. I didn't notice the day of the event, but they did line the causeway with, buses and lots of things to, obscure as much direct vantage as they could, anybody from the marina or anything like that. And then they did have, the boat launch there, which was directly adjacent to where he was speaking. There were, Sheriff's Department boats. And then beyond that, there were some, boats that were particularly selected from the marina for people to display, Trump flags and things like that. They were particularly vetted for that purpose. But for the most part, the day of our event, they did have some people that, they have people that they keep an eye on, that they kind of track around the country that are known troublemakers. And they did eject a couple of those people from our park. That they just happened to catch, what they were up to, who knows. No weapons were found or anything like that, but they were a couple individuals that were known, you know, instigators of different things, and they were ejected from the park. But for the most part, you know, our event went off pretty incident-free, aside from the heat. You know, we had some people that, you know, couldn't take the heat, but they were, fortunately helped by the Racine Fire Department and everything like that. But otherwise, our event was pretty orderly. Once it was over, everybody left in an orderly fashion. And, you know, fortunately, we didn't have an event, you know, like what happened today in Pennsylvania.
Kevin McDougall is sales manager for 5K Events, the organization that manages the City of Racine's Memorial Hall and Festival Park. He was interviewed by David Cole, WGTD General Manager, this past Saturday afternoon. And this interview will be available in its entirety on the podcast version of The Morning Show. You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and back now to the interview that I recorded back on Thursday with Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College. Let's talk for a moment. This will serve as kind of a segue to talking about President Biden. Let's talk for a moment about the first of their debates, which took place back on June 27th. As it so happens, that was a day when my wife and I were traveling, and it was impossible for me to watch that debate. And aside from just a couple of brief clips, it's actually only something I've read about and not really seen, actually. First of all, I wonder, first of all, in terms of the general assessment of how it went for Mr. Trump and for President Biden, would you agree with that kind of general assessment that it was a largely successful night for Mr. Trump and a not a good night at all for President Biden? I mean, did you, in a sense, assess it the same way?
So I completely agree with the characterization that it was an abysmal night for Mr. Biden. It's not like concerns about Mr. Biden's mental sharpness and communication skills all of a sudden emerged as a result of his poor debate performance. Those concerns were longstanding, and I think those concerns had been tamped down some by a couple of reasonably, you know, satisfactory public speeches that the president gave in the winter and in the spring, and a certain amount of resignation on the part of Democratic voters that, you know, well, all right, we'll get behind the president, even though we have these concerns. But they were brought to light and kind of affirmed in an extremely dramatic way. Mr. Biden seemed to get lost mentally. At times his train of thought broke down. He struggled at times to recall certain kinds of facts, to recall even where the direction of his speech was going. And physically he just looked uncertain, and it was just not a good performance. I guess, or I would say on the other side of the debate, I'm not sure it was a good night for Mr. Trump. He won it, for sure. You know, the characterizations that Mr. Trump lied, you know, repeatedly throughout the debate, those are factual characterizations. He did lie repeatedly and engaged in a lot of ad hominems, personal attacks on the president. And, you know, in some partial defense for Mr. Biden, it's hard to debate somebody who has, you know, no kind of commitment to telling the truth. A debate is really about how should we interpret these sets of facts, right? And we can debate, you know, are these the right facts? Are the facts completely facts? But when you throw out, I mean, utterly, you know, false claims, I mean, there's nothing you can do in a debate kind of context like that. Pushes what is supposed to be a reasonable discussion out of the realm of reason itself.
Right. I have read that one observation that was made by NPR, among others, was that there were ways in which the format of the debate did not serve the president very well. In particular, what they focused on was that it was a debate predicated on what might be called light moderation. That is, where the moderator or moderators did not play much of a hands-on role, did not exert a whole lot of control on the proceedings in the way that sometimes other moderators have been a much more prominent player, decisive player. And then also the matter of muting of mics and so on, which so I wonder if you share that perspective, that the format itself was in a sense likely to play to Mr. Trump's strengths versus President Biden's.
I think several elements of the debate format favored both camps. So on the one hand, the debate moderators made a firm commitment not to do any fact-checking in real time. And that kind of paved the way for either candidate to kind of, you know, say whatever they wanted without fear that they would be called on it by the moderators. On the one hand, you know, there's some problems with that, you know, but on the other hand, you can kind of see where CNN was coming from in making that decision, because then it becomes about, you know, moderators interfering in the process and so forth. And so I understand that. I think the fact that there was no audience favored the president, Mr. Biden, and Donald Trump likes to play well to audiences. So there's that. And I guess I would also say that the ability to mute the microphones of the two was a long coming characteristic for these debates. The amount of crosstalk that can happen is so infuriating to people who actually want to hear an intelligent political and policy conversation. So that was good. For sure. I think that the split screen nature of it didn't work to Biden's favor. So we got to see both men pretty much all the time. And, you know, I guess there were moments where Mr. Biden was kind of slack-jawed and not following what was going on very well, or seemed incredulous at times. And that didn't work to his advantage. So those were, I guess, my thoughts on the moderation or the format of the debate.
Well, it's probably time for us to kind of delve into this complicated and difficult question of the kind of rising chorus of voices who are suggesting that it might be best for President Biden to perhaps step down and have somebody else step into that position as presidential candidate in this upcoming election. First of all, maybe you could kind of sketch for us or summarize for us the kind of voices that have been heard in that call to the president, some House Democrats, at least one Senate Democrat, and a handful of noteworthy celebrities. All calling for this. Maybe you can kind of summarize where that's coming from, and right. And then we can talk about what might happen.
Well, I mean, the first calls are coming from columnists, writers in the media, of which there are now several score who are fairly prominent in terms of newspapers and magazines and so forth, who have called for the president to step down. Some of whom are very close personally to the president. Tom Friedman at the New York Times is a good example of that. So that's where it really started, and now it's I think a dozen. By the time our listeners are hearing this, I'm sure it'll be more than a dozen of House members, U.S. House members, have called on the president to step down. It is one senator as of Thursday. It's Peter
Peter Welch.
Facing his name.
Peter Welch, yeah.
From Vermont. Who's called on him to step down. A number of people who are running for seats right now, who are the nominees for congressional seats, have called on him to step down. George Clooney and Michael Douglas have weighed in. I don't think we should be taking our cues from Hollywood actors when it comes to civic responsibility. But of course, these men are significant contributors to the party, and so you know their thoughts are not unimportant from a party's perspective. And then you have pushback from the Biden camp that this is the kind of elites trying to drive him out, but that narrative doesn't hold water. When you look at the longstanding concerns that either a very large minority or even a small minority of Democrats have had for well over a year now, that multiple surveys have uncovered saying that they did not think Mr. Biden should run for re-election. And just this morning, the Washington Post Ipsos survey outfit released data showing that 56% of Democrats don't think he should continue, that he should, in fact, step aside. Only 42% of them said that he should continue. So it's, you know, the opposition is kind of top to bottom. Obviously, grassroots rank and file Democratic voters are very, very split on this question. When it comes to members of Congress, you know, there's not a large number who have come out officially to say that they think he should step aside. But unofficially, the numbers are much, much higher, which, of course, makes us think about President Trump's time in office, in which many Republican congresspersons were in private very opposed to things that the president was saying or doing, but publicly would not call him out. So there's this real kind of dynamic the Democratic Party is now wrestling with, that the Republican Party has had to wrestle with in previous years, about coming forth and challenging the standard bearer of your party.
Right. It seems to me that there are a couple of things going on here, and they're very closely related to one another, but they're not exactly the same thing. And one of the questions is whether or not Joe Biden still has the wherewithal, the physical and mental energy and acuity to continue to serve ably as president, versus the question of whether or not Joe Biden is likely to be able to defeat Donald Trump in this upcoming election. And they are, again, closely related matters, right, but not exactly the same. How would you have us kind of untangle this and these calls for President Biden to step down? Do you think those are being driven by one versus the other anymore?
Well, I think that there's much, much more support anyway amongst those who are expressing concern for Mr. Biden to step down as the nominee, but to finish out his term. I think that the people who are calling for him to step down and resign the presidency, which would elevate Kamala Harris to the presidency, that's a much, much smaller pool of people. If you think about it, in terms of these two kinds of related realms of activity, one, running for president, and two, being president, as you said correctly, they are very related. You can think of them as a Venn diagram in which, you know, one oval overlaps the other significantly. And in that overlap, right, I mean, you need to have good communication skills. You need to have good, sharp analytical ability. You have to have the capacity to relate and persuade and build and deliver arguments with other people. And so, you know, I mean, if you're not able to do that, then you're not either a good candidate to win the presidency, but you're also unlikely to be as effective as president should you do win. And I think that, you know, much of the narrative about Mr. Biden is that what we're seeing has been a kind of decline that is, you know, kind of accelerated in the last, you know, number of months, maybe in the last year. A number of people are saying that he's not the same man as he was in 2020. And so it's one thing to kind of say, look, I think that the President Biden has had a pretty good presidential term, right? They passed some key pieces of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act. They got reform on gun regulations, and they got some statutory support for gay marriage. All of those things are policy objectives that the Democratic Party very much wanted and is supportive of. But all those things came in the first 2 years of his term in office, and that's probably because the Democrats held the House of Representatives and they lost it in the midterms. But having lost the House, right, that kind of maybe coincides with this period of decline. At least that's what, you know, the possible narrative is about why he should step down as candidate.
So help us understand, first of all, what this would look like. And maybe we can also have you give your own prediction, if you care to, about how likely you think it is for President Biden to succumb to these pressures. But let's just for the moment assume that for one reason or another, he does end up taking himself out of this upcoming election as the incumbent. What would that then look like logistically? I mean,
right.
What would the party right. need to do? And I suppose part of the answer to that would depend on when such an announcement were made by President Biden.
Right. I mean, let's be upfront. Mr. Biden has won of more than is necessary the number of delegates to be the nominee. So legally, he's the nominee if he wants to be. And so any kind of replacement is going to be on the basis of him voluntarily deciding that the party isn't going to support him. And so he's going to step down. So that has to happen. He has to agree to do it. He would release his delegates. That would be one strategy. He could just say, look, my delegates are now released to vote for whomever they think is best fit to be the nominee. He could endorse somebody, right? The obvious choice would be his vice president. He could endorse her and ask his delegates, you know, to please support Ms. Harris. But in either situation, the delegates would have to figure that out, right? And so the question becomes, you know, does the party apparatus, the Democratic National Committee and, you know, the congressional leaders and the Democratic caucuses, do they all kind of rally around Ms. Harris and pressure, you know, and lobby the delegates to do the same? Or, you know, is there some kind of large collective commitment to being, you know, a truly open convention in which the delegates pick from a fairly large field? Then there are those who have argued that you could still hold a kind of mini primary. Jim Clyburn from South Carolina has said as much. James Carville has argued this in the New York Times, in which you have, you know, a couple of town halls that would be televised, maybe 6, 7, 8 candidates on stage making a pitch for themselves. Independently, they would probably give lots of public speeches. There'd be a lot of media attention on these people who, as they spent a couple of weeks in advance of the convention, making a case for themselves. In that period of time, you'd probably also have a whole lot of surveying of the public and of Democrats in particular to see, you know, what people's thoughts were about these respective competitors, so that when you get to the convention in Chicago in August, the delegates would have, you know, this a large amount of information, maybe not, you know, as much information as you'd have on a normal primary, but you'd at least have some information. They would be watching these town halls. They would be watching these speeches. They would have access to the survey data. And then at the convention in Chicago, they would begin the process of voting for the nominee. Mm. And that's how historically nominees were picked. Conventions would figure it out. Mm. So this would be a kind of turning back the clock to pre-1970s, where conventions really mattered.
Mm. It would be an interesting thing to see play out, but of course, there's no way at this point to know. I'm just curious if you care to venture a guess. What would you do? Do you have a prediction about how likely it is that the president might accede to the wishes of those who would like him to step out of this upcoming election?
Well, a couple of days ago, James Carville, in his article in the Times, said that the Biden candidacy is over. He said that there's no chance at this point that Biden will be able to salvage being the party's nominee. And I thought at the time when I read it just a couple of days ago that that was an overstatement, that he's essentially playing for effect to increase readership and attention to his article. But I'm not so sure at this point. It does feel to me like momentum to pressure Mr. Biden to step down is building, and it's really hard for me to see how the campaign effectively blunts the growing amount of concern that people are having about Mr. Biden as the nominee. Now, the existence of concern by itself doesn't matter, right? I mean, it has to. What it has to do in order to matter is convince Mr. Biden to step down. And I don't know. We really are in kind of Shakespearean realm of individuals, right? Individuals who are, you know, in possession of virtues and flaws, and you know, there's a bit of heroism, a bit of tragedy. All of this, right, is playing out, and I don't know what's you know going to happen as far as Mr. Biden's mindset goes.
Mm. And of course, you know, part of the question that I assume is weighing in his mind is his ability to defeat challenger Donald Trump, and that becomes, of course, a whole nother complicated question: whether or not President Biden steps down is what is the path to victory, and what is President Biden's path to victory versus the path of whoever would step into his place, and how that gets determined. It's an incredibly complicated, fascinating matter.
Well, it's really telling, I think, that Mr. Trump has been pretty quiet this past week. He has not been trying to venture into the public's attention. There's a saying, I think it's attributed to Napoleon, that when your enemy is in the process of defeating himself, don't interfere. So what's going on the Democratic side is certainly increasing the relative strength of Mr. Trump. Although I would say this, the Washington Post Ipsos data that I referred to a little while ago, in which 56% of Democrats wanted Mr. Biden to step down, only 11% of Republicans want Mr. Biden to step down. It's over 80% wanted to stay in the race. And I think that reflects a kind of calculus on Republicans' part that Mr. Biden is the easier candidate to defeat than somebody else. It seems really hard to envision a wounded and, you know, I guess I want to pick a polite term, a candidate who isn't what he was 4 years ago. It's hard for me to envision him winning. He's lost ground to Mr. Trump in the national numbers, not by a lot. I wouldn't expect it to be a lot, given how polarized the country is. But he's lost a little bit of ground, and he's lost a little bit of ground in all the key swing states. And if he's going to win the re-election, Mr. Biden has to change the minds of a number of independents in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And if his own party is kind of divided and his own abilities, his own skill set is not what it used to be, it seems hard to see him doing it.
Hmm. That was Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College, in interview excerpts recorded back on Thursday. The interview in its entirety, that is, the interview I recorded with Professor Mast on Thursday before Saturday's events unfolded in Butler, Pennsylvania, is available on the podcast version of The Morning Show. And to find the podcast, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Now 8:59 before we join Wisconsin Public Radio for their programming. Quick check on the forecast details from the National Weather Service. Slightly updated. They've moved the rain out of the daylight hours here towards late afternoon into the evening. Today, partly sunny, hot and humid, a high of 90, heat index near 102. Tonight, actually after 6 o'clock, cloudy, warm and rainy, good possibility of some severe thunderstorms, low 73. Right now, humidity 80%, 75 degrees Racine, 76 Kenosha. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.